you love America, you're among friends here.
Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. I start laundry at 8. At 10, we go for a walk. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m.
For those dealing with the daily struggles of caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community with experts and other caregivers for advice, tips, and support. Together, let's help each other better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
The first thing I remember knowing was a lonesome whistle blowing and a youngin's dream of growing up to ride on a freight train leaving town, not knowing where I'm bound, and no one could change my mind but Mama tried.
Welcome to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. Inside Tennessee is sponsored by the Tennessee Action Council, an educational organization dedicated to restoring constitutionally limited government and the Judeo-Christian values that made our country great. Visit our website at www.tn4action.com. That's www.tn4action.com. The phone number to call in and join a conversation is 718-305-7176. That's 718-305-7176. Thank everybody for joining us tonight. Apologies, we had some technical difficulties last week, and the show did not go on, unfortunately. Don't know what the source of that problem was, but we do apologize, and we will do better in the future on that. Well, we're starting the second week of the shutdown, and I'm actually kind of surprised that the GOP has not capitulated yet. Pleasantly surprised. So let's see, maybe they'll hold firm and actually get something out of this for a change. That would be great, wouldn't it? We've got a good show lined up tonight. We have Kathy Hinners with us tonight. She's a retired police officer from New York who thought she was going to retire here in Tennessee, but she's just as busy now as she ever was, and she's going to talk to us a little bit about the origins and the grand plan of the Muslim Brotherhood. We hear quite a bit about them, and she's going to go into a little detail that some of you might not be familiar with that. And later on, we're going to have Joanne Bregman, and Joanne Bregman is going to talk about refugee resettlement, and she's going to talk about how the shutdown is affecting refugee resettlement or how it's not affecting it in some cases. And then our last guest tonight will be Gary Lima, and Gary Lima is going to talk to us about the new organization that was created to basically as a replacement for the Boy Scouts, since the radical homosexuals have pretty much destroyed that or will in the near future. So we thank you for joining us, and we've got Kathy on the line here. We're going to go ahead and get started. How you doing tonight, Kathy?
I'm good. And yourself?
Fine. I appreciate you coming on. You know, Muslim Brotherhood has been in the news a lot. You know, you hear about them in Egypt, and a lot of people don't maybe realize it, but they are here, alive and well, unfortunately, and they have friends in high places. As a matter of fact, a lot of them have been appointed to high places in our government, especially when it comes to Homeland Security. But over the last couple of years, we've heard about the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and it's kind of come full circle if you know the origins of the Muslim Brotherhood. And I know just enough to be dangerous, so I'm going to leave it to the expert. And if you can tell us kind of how they started out, you know, who started it and what their intent was and what their goal was, which, by the way, has not changed.
No, you're right. It has not changed at all. But it started back in 1928. Actually, it was founded by a school teacher. His name was Hassan Albana. He was an Egyptian. Originally, he had formed this group to be focusing on education and charity work. But in order to implement Sharia law, which is the goal of every Muslim, it became a political movement, which obviously is evident, you know, as what's happening in Egypt now. There is no difference between an Egypt form of the Muslim Brotherhood or any Middle Eastern country Muslim Brotherhood than they are here. They are the same Muslim Brotherhood with the same ideology and the same goals. The primary goal of the Muslim Brotherhood is what's called a global caliphate, or one universal organization that's governed solely by the strict tenets of Sharia law. And Sharia law basically is means the way or the path. So basically what they're looking for is one religion, one government, and one law, which would be Sharia law. And when you look really at what's happening now, you can almost see how things are transpiring, so that we are going to end up eventually having one global organization. And I know that a lot of people think that that is far away, or, you know, not even going to happen at some point. But when you look at what they consider to be the four stages, and I think this is probably a good place to start before we get into the memorandum, but there are four stages of what they consider to be Islamic conquest. And the first one is called infiltration. And if you haven't been paying attention to the news and to what's happening in our schools and, you know, everything specifically here in Nashville, what's been happening in the schools, you know, this might come as a shock to you, but, you know, the first migration wave of non-Muslims to the United States, which has been going on since the 60s or probably even before that, you'll start to see mosques appearing more and more. Right now, we believe there's over 3,000 mosques within this country. They begin to criminalize any speech as they consider it to be Islamophobia, offers of
which is anything that
dialogue.
Disagrees with them, essentially, right?
Yes, and if you pay attention, the UN has a resolution 1618, which is called the Defamation of Religion Law. And that law was started back with Hillary Clinton and a guy by the name of Rashid Hussein, who is with the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, who's in this White House administration, actually. And they were working very closely with the UN to come up with this resolution, because in Islam it's called a blasphemy law. And so that sounded a little bit too much like the Quran, so they decided to name it the Defamation of Religion Law, which would mean that no one could speak out against Islam. So some of the things that they've done in stage one were already over. You know, the offers of the interfaith dialogue to indoctrinate non-Muslims, the threatened legal action for, you know, discrimination or bullying, these are things that are happening very quickly and really throughout Middle Tennessee specifically. But these things here are all in the first stage. And then, of course, you know, there's three other stages, and I could argue that I think we're probably closer to stage three. But when you look at stage two, which is called the consolidation of power, which is kind of interesting because it starts to get a little bit more overt instead of, you know, covert. The proselytizing increases, the efforts to destroy any historic evidence that reveal true Islamism, attempts to indoctrinate children in our educational systems, use of charities to support them, and it goes on quite a bit, but you can see where we are right now. And for those that don't, you know, want to believe this, it's basically history repeating itself. And the final two stages are, you know, we can get into that at another time, but they're not looking too good. That's really
Let's
the bottom
Let's hope we don't
line,
get right? into that. Let's hope we don't get that far.
Well, you know, Dave, I don't know what it's going to take, but there's a lot of things in stage three, which is open war / leadership and culture, that we are seeing in other countries. It's just not happening here yet. You know, when you talk about mass execution of non-Muslims, it just happened in Kenya. in the mall. And, as Dr. Warner will say, there's hundreds of thousands of Christians being killed throughout the world that no one's really paying attention to. And, your toppling of government and the usurp of political power and the forming of Islamic political powers. I mean, these are things that are kind of happening, and no one really wants to pay attention to that. So I would argue that we are probably somewhere in the third stage without the imposition of Sharia law, which is one of the final things here. But obviously we don't ever really want to reach the fourth stage, which would become that, Sharia is the law of the land and all of the religions are forbidden and basically destroyed. But these are the ideology that is behind the Muslim Brotherhood and the very groups that are here today. And when we look at the people that are pursuing this ideology, we don't see that. We see human beings. We see the, Rimziya Suleimans of Nashville who are very, charismatic and very friendly and nice. And we don't see the demonstrative ideology that's below that. And this is where we're at right now. So this document that we're talking about is called the Memorandum, the Strategic Goal for North America. And they've had this plan for several years. It was originally started in 87, and then it was finished in 1991. And we were very lucky to come upon this. It was found during a raid, and it's been used as evidence in a federal trial. So it has evidentiary value to it, and it has never been
disputed. That was the Holy Land trial, correct?
Yes, the Holy Land trial, which was this nation's largest terrorism financing trial in this country. And so it was used as evidence against the, people being charged.
Let me ask you something. Let me ask you something real quick. Now, you were still in law enforcement during the time of that trial, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Well, after that, did anything filter down to the different departments of, hey, here's what came out of it. This was something that the FBI turned up. Is that something that made it down to your level so that the average police officer would know, hey, look, there is this group called the Muslim Brotherhood, and they do have this plan? Did it ever make it down to that level?
No. And it still has not made it down to that level, which is so disturbing. And, I see it within my own department that I'm retired from. When I, suggested to them that they learn about these things and that I would be more than willing to give them a class on it, because I also do instruct across the country. I instruct law enforcement. I basically was told, well, we don't have that problem. So there's kind of a mindset there.
Right.
And some of the groups that are local.
Kathy, I've got to step in. I've got to do a live read here real quick, and then we'll get right back to you.
Okay.
Our friendly local pilot in command and GOP spokesman Duke Brooks calls himself a paleocon, and rightly so, since it's clear that anti-communism is in his DNA. His parents were friends with Joe McCarthy, Bill Buckley, and Whitaker Chambers, so what would you expect? There's no truth to the rumor that he has a dartboard with Alger's his picture on it, but you can get your weekly dosage of old-school conservatism, right-wing politics, American history, and hanger flying on Radio Free America with Duke Brooks, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central, on conservativenationmedia.com, where America always wins. Welcome back to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. The phone number is 718-305-7176, and we are talking to Kathy Henners about the explanatory memorandum that was written by the Muslim Brotherhood and discovered several years ago during an FBI raid. And we'll take it back to you, Kathy. Basically, it has not made it down to the street level. Police officers, even though this was evidence introduced in a trial by the FBI, it hasn't filtered down for whatever reason.
No. Well, it's considered probably very controversial and politically incorrect to delve into something like this because, we are talking about a group that uses religion as a guise in this country, and we all know we have freedom of religion. So a lot of people are very reluctant to actually open themselves up to see what this religion, if you will, is doing to to our society. But as far as law enforcement, it is considered politically incorrect to really say anything against this religion. So therefore, it's, you know, when we go into a mosque, the group CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, they are now insisting that when police officers go into any of their community centers or mosques, that they promise them that they will not take any notes, that they won't take any license plates or any names, or any intelligence, basically, and then use that against the mosque at a later date. So CARE is setting these law enforcement policies across the country. And most, I shouldn't say most, but I guess I'll say most, higher echelon in most police departments are not willing to go against that and say, well, no, we're here for this specific reason, and we're going to do what we have to do. So we're very reluctant to get into something because no one wants to be labeled a bigot or an Islamophobe or a racist. And certainly police departments that, you know, take federal funding are not open to losing that funding if they start, you know, doing anything that would be construed as anti-Islam. So it's very, very difficult. But this document that was found in this raid has been a treasure trove of information for law enforcement, basically, to be able to conduct investigations on the several groups that they've named. I mean, they've given you a list of 29 organizations that are here within this country that are Muslim Brotherhood organizations. The Muslim Brotherhood is considered to be a terrorist organization. So, you know, hand in hand here, they're giving you the names and what they're doing, and yet our hands are tied and we're not able to do anything because they fall under the religious, genre, if you will. So there's a lot of, it's not even just law enforcement, but we seem to get the brunt of it, if you will. But it's very difficult because in this document, they're very clear as to what, you know, they intend to do. And I would say they're probably well into the goal of what they say they are going to do. So if anybody has the document or they want to see the document, certainly, Dave, I'm sure you can and I can. If they email me, if they can go to dailyrollcall.com, that is on the website under documents, and my email is there, so they could email me specifically for the document if that's how they want to do it, or I'm sure they could email you as well for the document. But when you look at the document, go ahead.
I was going to say there's another website as well, which we, on that website, we have yours listed. We have Tennessee for Political Justice and Bill Warner stuff, but we have another website called BillHislam.com. We started that in honor of our governor, who is just so infatuated with these Islamists. So we have the documents there as well. We're going to have to take a real quick break.
Okay.
And appreciate everybody just staying with us. We'll be right back on Inside Tennessee, and we'll talk some more with Kathy Henners. Don't go away.
80 million voters can pull the wrong lever, and it's still the wrong lever.
It feels like you're frozen, petrified. You're struggling with your mortgage payments. The bills begin to pile up. Not knowing what to do, you do nothing at all. And that's the worst thing you can do. Because if you take action, if you do something about your mortgage problems, you're far more likely to get the most positive outcome. Making Home Affordable is a free government program. Call 888-995-HOPE to talk one-on-one with a housing expert about the options that are right for you. Real help, real answers, right now. Call 888-995-HOPE or visit makinghomeaffordable.gov and do something about your mortgage problems. Brought to you by the U.S. Treasury, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. The phone number is 718-305-7176, and we're talking to Kathy Henners about the explanatory memorandum of the Muslim Brotherhood. Kathy, we have a caller on the line. Let's see if they have a question or a comment.
Okay.
Caller, do you have a question or a comment? Hello, 202, do you have a question?
No, just tuning in. Thank you.
Okay, well, we appreciate that.
All right.
Hi. Okay, Kathy, we were just getting into the memorandum before the break, so I'll turn it back over to you.
Okay. If, you know, someone does take a look at the document itself, it's rather lengthy, but and it's kind of difficult to read because it's in kind of a strange breakdown of the language. It is in English, but it's kind of different to read, so it takes some time to understand what it's saying. But when you look at the organizations that they talk about as being friends of the Muslim Brotherhood, who all have the same ideology, we're talking about ones that are very prevalent within the United States, which is, I find, to be very disturbing. But the very first one is called the Islamic Society of North America, and that is, if you would picture like the Muslim Brotherhood being the umbrella organization and then like a hierarchy of different organizations, and the Islamic Society of North America certainly is one of the higher and larger organizations within this country. And what's really disturbing is they just had their 50th year anniversary conference in Washington, D.C., and it was attended by several people from this administration. So, you know, why we're attending Muslim Brotherhood terrorist organization conferences, you know, I'll leave that up for people to decide. But there are several.
Well, we've appointed them.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not really all that surprised if we would attend them.
I had just received an email, someone asking me if it was true that there were Muslim Brotherhood operatives, if you will, in the White House, and I was like, well, yeah, and one of the more popular ones, especially when I teach in Dallas, is a gentleman by the name of Mohammed El-Libiari, who just received a promotion, actually. He works for the Department of Homeland Security under Janet Napolitano, and he just received a promotion. So they are moving up and they are moving in, so that's just something to keep in mind. The second organization would be the Muslim Student Association. And I think every parent should make sure that the college that they're sending their child to is aware of this Islamic organization. They are in just about every university and college campus throughout this country. Something new is now they're starting to branch out into community colleges, which they never were before. And now we're also learning that they're becoming active in high schools. And I will tell you that the Martin Luther King Magnet School in Nashville, I believe, is probably going to be one of the first high schools in this area to have that title of having the Muslim Student Association as being part of their groups for their children to join. So I don't know if people aren't aware of these sorts of organizations, but they're moving into high school. So obviously the indoctrination process for the children is starting to take place in high school. It's bad enough that they're doing it in textbooks in the middle and elementary schools, but now we have these groups, you know, coming into the high schools. So it's a pretty dangerous thing that's happening, and people just aren't paying attention. I don't know if they're not paying attention or if they just don't want to see what's happening, but it is happening fast and furious, you know, in this country, so they need to be aware of it. And then there's a few other organizations, the IAP, which used to be the Islamic Association for Palestine, which is now CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations. I believe they just changed their name. I'm going to have to find out what it is. But I did get an email that CARE is now changing their name because they were just sued in a lawsuit, and they were found to be laundering money and committing some fraudulent activities, go figure, throughout this country with other... Yeah. So CARE, which operates here in several states, I believe there's 37 or 38 chapters now within this country, is changing their name again so that they can't be associated with, you know, the old care. So, you know, this is something I need to look into a little bit more. And there are several other groups. Another one is called the Islamic Circle of North America, and that is more the organization that promotes dawah, or the proselytizing of Islam.
You mentioned Remza Suleiman, and of course we have Sumar Ali, and we have other prominent Muslims in the state that people look at them, and it seems to be okay if the person is well educated, speaks English well, is successful, and especially if they happen to be born here, then they could not possibly be a threat in any way, shape, or form. They could not possibly share the same ideology as the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt or in the Middle East. And I think that's what people get hung up on. They're expecting, and when you say somebody is supporting radical Islam or supporting Sharia or whatever, they're picturing somebody in a turban and sandals and a man dress with a bomb strapped to them.
Yes,
and
exactly.
That is not what we're saying. That's not the case. But they are all on the same team. They just have different roles.
Yes.
And I think that's one of the most frustrating things.
And you're absolutely right, because, you know, it isn't in the Middle East where they're coming out of caves and, you know, like you say, with the bombs on them and everything else. But this is all part of the doctrine. This is all the way that they will do it. I mean, they are human beings. They are, you know, when you look at them and you speak to them, they're funny, they're charismatic, they're human. So it's very hard for us to imagine that they're undermining our very society. But when you look at some of the, especially the younger women that are very much involved with these Muslim Brotherhood organizations, such as Remzia Suleiman, you look at them and you think, there's no way. You know, they're very peaceful, they're very religious. But what's kind of interesting is that there have been some videos that have come out that are showing these women in a completely different light. And what's interesting is that it isn't just someone dictating to an audience. It is from their mouths that they are saying these things. Ms. Suleiman here, these videos show her very clearly with Muslim Brotherhood organizations and speaking on behalf of these Muslim Brotherhood organizations and also members of the Muslim Brotherhood organizations. So how do you, you know, Photoshop that, or how do you make that, you know, how do you glaze that over when it's there, it's her speaking, it's her, you know? So it's very difficult, I understand, for people to swallow this. But one of the big things is that Remzia Suleiman is going to be a keynote speaker at the Religious Communicators Council conference in Opryland next April. And, you know, I think that they need to know. We've asked people to start writing them and to call them and to tell them, you know, this woman, here's a video. You know, she admits that she's working with these organizations. It's bad enough to get someone to understand that these people have this set of goals for this country. You know, then look at their document and try to understand what their document is saying. But when you put the two together, it's very clear what they're saying they're going to do and what they are doing. And these people are pushing that agenda. So you have to kind of look at it as, you know, are they the enemy? I mean, they are changing our lifestyle. So are they an enemy? And it's hard for people to do.
And the term they use in the document, which everybody needs to become familiar with, is civilization jihad. Or they talk about the civilization jihad process, which is pretty much what we just talked about. They're not going to appear as a threat. They're going to try to appear as peaceful people that just have a different religion and blah, 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 but they still have the same goal. But it's that whole process that people need to be aware of, leery of. And I think that's, you know, one of the biggest challenges. We've got to take a real quick break, and then we'll be right back. Don't go away. We've got some more with Kathy Henners on Inside Tennessee.
Americans have known Tennessee as the volunteer state since the War of 1812. Now, Tennessee is leading the way in another major conflict, the war to keep America's identity, values, and freedoms intact. Even if you've never walked in Memphis or hiked the Blue Ridge Mountains, if you respect traditional American values, you should know about the Tennessee Action Council. Tennessee Action Council fights to preserve American values, defend our way of life, and protect the U.S. Constitution. This isn't just Tennessee's battle. It affects every American who loves our country and wants to pass the real America, unstained by progressive liberalism, along to future generations. No matter where you are in this magnificent country of ours, Tennessee Action Council is on your side and on America's side. Go to TN4Action.com, that's TN, the number 4, Action.com, to volunteer for Tennessee and America. That's TN, the number 4, Action.com, to stand for America now.
Happy anniversary, honey.
Oh, you shouldn't have. Wait, is that a goat?
Goats are a great gift, but maybe not for her. Go to goatsfortheoldgoat.com to give a goat and end hunger in South Sudan. So, do you like it? Goatsfortheoldgoat.com.
Welcome back to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. The phone number is 718-305-7176, and we're talking to Kathy Henners discussing the explanatory memorandum of the Muslim Brotherhood. And Kathy, we were talking before the break about the civilization jihad process, and we'll turn it back over to you.
All right, and I think that that's an important part, Dave, because in the document itself, on page 7, for those that might be interested in this, where it says, understanding the role of the Muslim Brother in North America, it actually says that the process of settlement is a civilization jihadist process. The Ikhwan, which is brotherhood, must understand that their work in America is a kind of grand jihad in eliminating and destroying the Western civilization from within, and sabotaging its miserable house by their hands and the hands of the believers so that it is eliminated and God's religion is made victorious over all other religions. So they're telling you that, you know, that they're going to destroy us from within. I mean, even Gaddafi had said that they don't need bombs and guns and war to take over the UK and the US. They would just destroy us from within. And basically, if you can look at it like a, you know, like a weed coming up through a crack, you know, we should be yanking it out and putting, you know, death to the roots, where instead we seem to be putting miracle grow, because it is a religion.
Yeah.
And
it's
this
Obama
is what
grow.
You know, yeah, exactly. But this is exactly what they're doing. They're telling us that they're doing this, and yet we continue to nurture this as a religion. And, you know, because it has a holy book, doesn't necessarily mean that it's strictly a religion. I mean, it is a way of life. It is a political way of life. And, you know, so we don't look at it that way, and yet our very freedoms are what's going to come back to kill us. You know, the freedom of religion, they use that to the extreme, knowing that we will not go after another religion. And I think that it's imperative that people start to understand and to look at it as something other than a religion. You know, no one wants to be the first to say that, but this is what needs to be done in order to understand this ideology. You have to get rid of, you have to separate the religion from what they're intending to do. There's nothing peaceful and loving about taking over a society and changing a society and killing people if they don't wish to convert to Islam. And this is, you know, one of the stages, probably the final stage, here is where they would, you know, either put a tax on you, which is called a jizya, or demand that you convert to Islam or kill you. And we see in a lot of the Middle Eastern countries, the jizya has gone right out the door. They're not even doing that anymore. In a lot of countries, they're just flat out killing people. And, you know, a lot of things have come out of the massacre in the mall in Kenya. And I think that people need to really pay attention to that, because they were specifically asking people if they were Muslims. Some people tried to say, yes, they were, and then they would ask them a specific question about Islam or Muhammad, and if they couldn't answer, then they were executed. But they weren't just executing people, Dave. They were torturing people. So, you know, we think, oh, that's Africa. Well, you know what? There's a lot of Americans in Africa, and we have an African terrorist organization here called Al-Shabaab. And so this could happen in a mall here. And yet we're too busy. You know, we're too busy. We got a soccer game or something else. And I know it's doom and gloom, but you know what? It's going to be worse. You're not going to have that soccer game to go to if we let this continue. So yeah, it's very disturbing.
You got to get your head out of the sand while you still have one.
Yes, exactly. You know, you talk about the beheadings that are done, and I think to be beheaded, you know, very quickly would be a blessing, as opposed to some of the things that they did to some of the people in Kenya. But when you, again, when you look at this document, they are speaking out, telling you, they use numerical order for the processes that they're talking about. The understanding that we cannot perform the settlement mission by ourselves or away from people. They talk about the need to have these organizations are very, very important, because so many of these organizations perform charities within the communities. And you start to see it here in Middle Tennessee. So if you can take what the document says and apply it to what is actually being done, for instance, the Islamic Center of Nashville has been having health fairs. They're bringing in people that maybe can't afford with, you know, the new Obamacare stuff. They're bringing them in for vaccinations or, you know, cancer screenings or mammograms. And they're doing all these great things for the community. So, you know, people look at that and say, well, how are they terrorists when they're helping poor people or old people? But this is what they do. They do the charity in order to endear themselves to the community. That's what they're supposed to do, and that's what they do. So the whole idea of generosity and love and everything seems very nice, but if you understood the reason, you know, that they're doing it. What's interesting, too, is one of the movements in several documents, they talk about how homosexuality is against their religion, is against their law. And there are several writings about, you know, throwing homosexuals off cliffs and, you know, beheading them and killing them. And yet we're finding a lot of the Middle Tennessee groups are embracing the gay community, and the gay community is embracing them back. And it's kind of sad to watch, because, you know, they'll turn around, and we have several of them on tape. This was another video that actually came out about a gentleman from Memphis, Yasser Qadi, who talks about homosexuals and how they need to die. And so, you know, how do you embrace them when they want to kill you? So,
Takiya,
you know,
in action.
Yeah, you know, that's very frightening, but so much in the document, you know, they're so far along with things that they talk about winning factions and colors in America and Canada. They just go on and on about how they're going to do this. So I guess I fail to understand how people can listen to people tell you what they're going to do and read what they say they're going to do to you, and look at the news and see that they're doing it, and then still go back to bed and say, well, everything will be okay. It's almost Christmas. it really doesn't work that way. There's not going to be a Christmas when you start looking at how Christians in particular are being dismantled. The religion is being dismantled. you know, when you can't say Happy Easter or Happy or Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, yeah.
Yeah.
And they're even cracking down in the military. They were this weekend with the shutdowns. They apparently some of the chaplains are contractors, and they wouldn't allow them, even those who wanted to volunteer, to go and do a service on the weekend. Oh, no, you can't do that. Not only can't you do that, if you do that, you will face legal action. So, hey, I want to take a call real quick. And, Gary, how we doing?
I'm doing okay. How you doing today?
All right. You got a question or a comment?
No, I called in to do the can make comment on that, but I called in to do the issue of the new scouting program. But I agree with all that I've been listening to so far, that what I had learned back in the 1984 in the narrative I wrote and I brought to the lieutenant governor in person 2 marches ago, this is all facade, and this is a conquering form of theology where government and religion are one. And the problem with our side or our people looking at the differences is this country was founded by Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And when we said religion, we meant what method of worship in Christianity. And, of course, Judaism, some argued Judaism was, you know, fine too. But I have read a couple of documents where Islam was looked at by some founding fathers, you know, in minor works, and they saw it as a not viable for our form of government.
You're right.
Yeah, it's completely incompatible. Yeah. Completely.
Yes,
I think
is.
I may have given you a wrong time, Gary. It's 8:30 was the time. I apologize.
Oh, that's okay. No problem. I can call back in at 8:30.
Okay.
I'm glad he's listening. Thank you.
I appreciate it.
I'm listening.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Gary. Take it.
You know, he hits it, you know, right on the head, basically, because, you know, what we were founded on, and this religion, if you will, is so antithetical to what we believe, and it is not, you know, for the Constitution. And what people don't understand is that there cannot be any man-made law according to Sharia law.
Yep.
So
the Constitution would fall in that category, yes.
Yes.
I've got to take a real quick reading break here, and
okay.
Don't go away. We'll be right back. ConservativeNationMedia.com is growing, and we couldn't think of a better way to expand our lineup than to give our very own Bing Fisher his very own show. Uncle Bing Fisher brings his engineer's insight and love America to American by Design, Sunday evenings at 6 p.m. Eastern, 5 Central, immediately following Soldier of Patriotism with Michael Smith on ConservativeNationMedia.com. So stay with Conservative Nation Media 7 days a week, since we're making some big changes and we're just getting started. American by Design with Bing Fisher, Sundays at 6 Eastern, 5 Central on ConservativeNationMedia.com, where America always wins. Welcome back to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. Phone number is 718-305-7176, and we are talking to Kathy Henners about the Muslim infiltration, specifically about their explanatory memorandum. And Kathy, before the break, we were talking about how essentially Sharia and the Constitution are incompatible. There's no way to reconcile the two.
No. No, it's religious law. Sharia is obviously, it's a political way of life, but it is basically derived from the Sunnah or the Hadith. So it is religious in that aspect. So the Constitution, which gives us, you know, our society as it is, would be changed because they cannot abide by the Constitution, being that it was man-made. So when you see a Muslim, you know, ask them, well, how does a Muslim live properly in a non-Muslim state? And, of course, the answer probably will be, well, that's why we're turning it into an Islamic state, because that is the global caliphate. That is the whole, you know, the whole idea is to reestablish the firm Islamic states. And when you look at how many aspects of our society that they have entrenched themselves in, it's rather eye-opening. And this is what they also say in the document, is that there is a, you know, they call for a media center, and they break it down of what kind of media centers they need. Well, what did we just get? We just got Al Jazeera television. So obviously their media is in place. You talk about education and the need for youth organizations. And we just struggled with textbooks, seeing that the textbooks, you know, that are so anti-Christian and pro-Islam. And then the youth movements, you know, we have something called MIST, the Muslim Interscholastic Tournament, which is brand new, coming to Nashville, which is something that will be into the high schools and colleges. So there's a lot of things that they're saying, women's organizations and social organizations, political organizations. They're telling you what they're forming, and yet we're not looking at that. I will say, on the textbook note, if I can for just 1 second, congratulate everyone that worked on the textbooks, because they were turned down today in the final hearing for the legislature. The textbook commission, they did win when they were asked to vote on keeping the textbooks that were supposed to be going into the schools. There was utter silence. There was nothing. So they did win, and these people have worked so hard for an entire summer, if not longer, to get these textbooks out of our schools. So I just wanted to point that out. I don't know if you heard that or not today, but
I heard something about it, but I didn't hear all the details. Now, is that just a high school textbook, or is that a series of textbooks, or what are we talking?
I believe it's the whole series of textbooks. Actually, the commission even threw out a kindergarten book, which was, I guess, supported by the group. They said that there was really nothing, you know, wrong in the kindergarten book, but they threw out the entire series of books. And I guess there was a representative from Pearson Publishers there, which Pearson's probably one of the most offensive textbooks in the market. And it was quite a moment. It was quite a victory for these folks that had been working so incredibly hard all summer. You know, they were at the library over at MTSU every single day. And you've met some of these folks, too, that were there, that were actually doing the work. And it paid off. And so I think this is a victory for, certainly for Tennessee. And I think that it kind of re-energizes you to keep going forward and saying, well, if we won that, what's next?
Do you know the name of the organization that was able to do that? Do you know who? I mean, I think I know some of
the people. I'm not sure if any one particular organization. I know there was Parents for Truth in Education. There was ACT chapters involved. Truth in Education. I'm not sure some of the groups that Lisa Moore and Jackie Archer from Murfreesboro certainly played a huge part.
Yeah.
Julie West from Franklin. You know, there was a whole entourage of people that came together. And that's what it's about. There's no room for ego, you know, in this business. It's everybody, if you have information, you need to give it to whoever you're working with and get that information out there. So a group of people came together and put everything else, you know, their lives aside, and they won. And I think it's a great victory, and I'm thrilled for these people, because to work that hard and then to have it pay off is great.
Yeah.
So hopefully,
hopefully the first of many more.
Yeah, I hope so, you know, but we've got a lot of work to do. You know, when you look at this memorandum, you become overwhelmed. I think, well, how can I as one person, you know, do anything? But there's lots of things you can do, and this is proof that it works.
Well, Kathy, what we're going to do is we're about out of time for the night, but we're going to have you back. We're going to have you on a regular basis, and we're going to work off of this memorandum. So the next time before you come on, I will email out the memorandum, and if you know what parts you're going to address, I can identify that when I mail it out to the list, and I'll see if we can get it posted up on the Blog Talk site as well. Well, I appreciate you being with us, and it's always great to have you, and hope to have you back soon.
All right. Thanks, Dave.
All right. Take care. Hey, don't go away. We will be right back with Joanne Bregman. We're going to talk about refugee resettlement and the government shutdown. Stay right with us. Don't go away. Thanks.
Hey, liberals, why don't you try rooting for your own damn country for a change?
Adopting a new pet is a rewarding experience. And Shelter Pets make super pets. Your new best friend will steal your heart, bring you happiness, and enrich your life for years to come. You can make a difference in the life of an animal. Adopt and bring home a Shelter Pet today. To find out more, visit theshelterpetproject.org. This message has been brought to you by the Humane Society of the United States, Maddie's Fund, and the Ad Council.
Foreclosure is hard on every member of the family, but your family is not alone. If you're struggling with your mortgage, there is help. To learn about the government's Making Home Affordable program, visit makinghomeaffordable.gov or call 1-888-995-HOPE to speak to a HUD-approved housing counselor. It's free of charge. Visit makinghomeaffordable.gov or call 1-888-995-HOPE today. Brought to you by the U.S. Treasury, HUD, NeighborWorks America, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. Phone number is 718-305-7176. And our next guest is Joanne Bregman. And we're going to talk about refugee resettlement. How are you doing tonight, Joanne?
I am very well, thanks, Dave. And you?
Doing fine.
Dave,
appreciate you coming on.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah,
thanks.
What you got?
You know, one thing I want to mention, I want to remind people of, is that, you know, the reason that we are finally getting to have a rational discussion, fact-based discussion, which is what I like to deal with. I like to deal in facts. I really don't like to deal in emotion because I don't think that moves the issue forward. And I think people are, I like to think that people are intelligent enough to take the facts and process them themselves and see where they come out on them. So, you know, we need to be reminded that the reason that we are getting to have a rational, objective, fact-based discussion about this issue in Tennessee is because of the legislative oversight advisory committee that was engineered by State Representative Judd Matheny and Senator Mike Bell, which, as you know, is chaired under the Joint Government Operations Committee. And I also want to remind people that, you know, one other very groundbreaking initiative that this committee has put on the table, and which, as I understand, has the support of the Speaker of the House and Lieutenant Governor, is calling for a bilateral session of Congress, which means that our federal delegation and our state and our state House and Senate chambers would all come together in a public forum to discuss the issues of priority for the state of Tennessee. And that's what this particular committee is dealing with. And I think certainly when we look at an issue like refugee resettlement and the relationship between the state and the federal government as the program is implemented in Tennessee, it's very appropriate for this bilateral session to come together. Obviously, this would not be the only issue and might not even be one of their top issues, but having that open dialogue, and I think it's really going to take the citizens of Tennessee. I would encourage everybody to be emailing your federal state your federal representative and your federal senator, as well as your state House member and your state senator, and tell them that you really support calling this bilateral session.
Joanne, let me interject just a little bit. A little bird somewhere mentioned that there hadn't been any response on that from Senator Corker. I think some feelers had put out and hadn't heard anything from Senator Corker on that. So, you know, maybe he needs to be reminded a little more
want. Yeah, and I think I don't know anything about that particularly, but I do think what it's telling us is that if the citizens of Tennessee, look, it's our government, and if we don't remind our federal and state representatives what what we want and what we've put them in office to do, then we only have ourselves to blame. So I encourage everybody to contact your representatives, federal and state level, and tell them that, yes, it's time for this. I mean, the relationship between Washington and the state is very, there's a lot of tension and fracture in terms of how the federal government perceives the role of the state, if you will, which is why I think the Refugee Resettlement Program is such a good illustration of that when we look at the federal cost shifting. And I will tell you, with the government shutdown, even though technically, you know, the government's not totally shut down, but certainly parts of the government are not operating. And I do want to talk about that impact on the Refugee Resettlement Program, because one of the two things in particular, refugees that were supposed to be flown over to the United States for resettlement, that's been suspended at least until October 21st. And that was reported by one of the big resettlement agencies. But I think more importantly, the federal government has suspended the provision of federal cash and medical assistance to refugees who do not qualify for the state-funded Medicaid and welfare programs. And one of the things that was discussed in the in Representative Matheny's committee in August was the fact that that federal allocation for refugees who are not eligible for state-funded safety net programs, that federal money is not going to be paid right now. So that means that refugees who are already in the country, who have already been resettled, and who are receiving that federal assistance, are not going to be get it. They're not going to get it. And that was part of the federal commitment, which, by the way, when they originally made the commitment in 1980, they were providing that for 3 years. And then through a series of reductions, ended up in 1991, reducing that federal support to 8 months of support, meaning that refugees who have come here who are not eligible for Medicaid, which is TennCare in Tennessee, or TANF, which is Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, and that is cash welfare, we're getting this 8 months of federal support, and that's all they're going to get. So, you look at what the federal government promises to do and then what they actually end up doing. So, you know, I look at it with a somewhat skeptical eye, because they did the same thing when they were reimbursing the state for the state-funded portion of that cost at 100%. And again, over time, by 1991, eliminated the reimbursement to the states altogether. So I kind of look at this and say, well, when the government goes back up and they start looking at where they're going to make good on the commitments that they've made, or where they may have a little bit more leeway, perhaps, to shift yet more costs to the states, because they've had no problem admitting that they are shifting the cost of their program to the states, we may not see that money coming back to the states for the cash and medical assistance. You know, I don't know, but I'm just a little skeptical about the federal government. I will tell you that.
Wait a minute. You mean you don't trust the federal government?
Well, I think that they very easily reorder their priorities, and they reorder their priorities perhaps without paying a real close eye to what commitments they've made in the past.
Right.
I do think that, you know, they put everything under the quote-unquote national interest first. And in truth, you know, states are kind of left holding the bag. Anyway, I will tell you, so for 2014, the president has sent to Congress, and supposedly Congress has approved, although it's a fairly rubber stamp process, 70,000 refugees for 2014. And I read a really interesting comparison. Someone said that when you look at the number that's been approved for 2014, that's a population larger than Iowa City. It's a very interesting way to look at it. I will say, and I also want to go back, that when the Refugee Resettlement Program was formalized by the Federal Act in 1980, The original
intent.
Yes,
Joanne,
sir?
I'm gonna have to jump in just a second. We're gonna have to take a quick break, and
sure,
when
no
we
problem.
Come back, we'll start right there with what it was supposed to have been in 1980 and what it's morphed into now. Either way, we end up paying the bill, whether we pay it at the federal level or we get slammed at the state level. The feds stick it to us one way or the other. Don't go away. We'll be right back on Inside Tennessee.
If you love America, you're among friends here. ConservativeNationRadio.org.
My name is Dale Pazinski. I'm 19 years old, and this is how I live United. I've always been kind of a computer geek, and I found a way to use those skills to help the homeless in my community. For people facing hard times, computer skills and a basic resume are so important. It may seem like a small thing, but it makes a huge difference in people's lives. So with United Way, I created a program where I work with the homeless. Together, we go through their whole job history, write a resume, and then save it on the very own USB drive. We provide workbooks and training certificates. I even budgeted for cupcakes so we can celebrate as a class when one of our people gets a job. That's huge. When somebody says, "Hey man, that job that you helped me apply for, I got it." That's what living United feels like to me. My name is Dale Pazinski. I help people achieve financial independence. So I don't just wear the shirt, I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live United. Go to liveunited.org, brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
There's no time to kill between the cradle and the grave. Father, time still takes a toll on every minute.
Welcome back to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. The phone number is 718-305-7176. We're talking to Joanne Bregman, and the topic is refugee resettlement, specifically here in Tennessee. Joanne, before the break, you were talking about how the Refugee Act was originally set up in 1980. What was it set up to be like, and what do we get stuck with now?
Well, I think one of the more important aspects about that original legislation was that it was designed to be a public-private partnership, meaning that the organizations, and now it's 9 national, what they call voluntary organizations, that contract with the State Department to help the federal government implement their program. Well, that was supposed to be this public-private partnership, and it was translated. They signed what's called the cooperative agreement, and in that agreement it specifically says that the federal money is only supposed to augment private funds that these organizations raise to then engage in their resettlement activities. And what that means is that the majority of the money is supposed to be privately raised, and then the federal government kind of tops that off some. So I thought, you know, it's really interesting. Let's look and see what these organizations have done to what kind of money they've raised that the federal government's augmenting. And actually what we see is that they are totally reliant on federal funds. Take, for example, the Lutheran Social Services of Minnesota, okay? Now, their parent organization is Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services, and it's one of those big 9 national resettlement parent organizations. The 2010-2011 990 for Lutheran Social Service, which is the latest that we can find, and they are the federal contracting arm for refugee resettlement of the Lutheran organization, shows that they had $89 million in revenue. $63.3 million of that came from government fees and contracts, and another $5.2 million was pass-through money, which usually is how the federal money coming from the parent organization is described. I'll tell you something really interesting. The former president and CEO of Lutheran Social Services of Minnesota, which is the resettlement agency operating in Minnesota, he was paid over $400,000 in salary.
Boy, he's roughing it, huh?
Well, I think we're in the wrong business. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, which is the parent organization of Catholic Charities of Tennessee that operates refugee resettlement here in Tennessee, in 2012, they reported that almost 93%, which was approximately $67 million of its refugee resettlement budget, was federal money, and less than $25,000 came from private donations. I can also tell you that one of the newest resettlement agencies in Nashville, which opened 4 years ago, reported in 2012 that 90% of its total funding came from the federal government. Let me ask you something on this.
So when they wrote this federal law, they didn't lay out hard, clear, concise percentages. Okay, you will provide 75 or 80% of your own funding. We will fund no more than 20. They just said, okay, the majority of this is supposed to come from voluntary, through your efforts to fund yourself, and we will supplement. There's no oversight. There's no hard rules on this.
No. And if you think of kind of the evolution of the refugee resettlement program in our country, it used to be traditionally, it was a true humanitarian, charitable undertaking where individuals actually sponsored individual refugees. I have to reach back way long ago in my almost what I would call my past life. I actually volunteered with a refugee resettlement agency when I lived in Washington. And that was a long time ago. It was after the 1980 Act was passed. But the way that agency operated, you literally paired individuals with individuals. So you were responsible for really taking them in hand and walking them through. And even further back before the 1980 Act, when you sponsored a refugee, you were also financially responsible for them. And what that morphed into, of course, was after the 1980 Act was passed, was now it's just a federal contractor business. It is truly an industry, and you really don't have that the responsibility, the ultimate responsibility is almost nobody's, because the agency that resettles has a 90-day commitment, and then technically they're off the hook. And you listen, it is easy to find the reports from both refugees themselves as well as refugee advocates, people who are in the industry but feel that the industry and these resettlement agencies are failing the refugees they're bringing, because they're kind of just bringing them in, signing them up for social services, and really then turning them loose. So what started out as a true service, humanitarian service, is now a competitive federal contracting industry. And I will tell you, as evidence of that, I wanted to get copies of some of the resettlement abstracts that are filed every year by the resettlement agencies, where they propose how many refugees they're going to bring into a community. And I was told that I had to file a Freedom of Information Act request to get copies of those documents. I filed that in April, and I'm still waiting. And the reason they said is that was proprietary information. Not only that, you're not even allowed to see the ones that are submitted for bid before the fiscal year starts, which I think is really somewhat counterintuitive to the way they tell you publicly that this is a humanitarian service. And in fact, they say, they only sign these cooperative agreements. Well, when you cut through all the layers, it is a federal, I call it bidding for bodies, because it is a federal contracting business. And if they're telling us that the proposals or the bids cannot be seen or looked at by the public until the federal award is made, I think that's like talking out of both sides of your mouth. So in other words, I live in Davidson County. I can't see the proposals that have been submitted to the federal government by these private nonprofits who are waiting to find out how much money they're going to make. I, as a taxpayer, am not allowed to see those proposals until they're awarded, and that's only if someday they actually answer my FOIA request. So,
right, and there's currently no there's currently no state oversight. I mean, there's no state official because the governor gave this up. He gave up on it a few years ago. Governor Bredesen did, and this private agency stepped up. So we don't even have anybody that represents us. We have a private organization, an NGO, dealing directly with the State Department / federal government, and the people of Tennessee have no say on this currently.
And I will tell you, when you really study kind of the way the infrastructure is structured now, what you see is that this private NGO has a big financial stake in keeping it exactly out as it is. Because when Governor Bredesen took the state out of this program, and it is a non-mandatory federal program, so, you know, the state is allowed to withdraw. When that happened, the U.S. Office of Refugee Resettlement then interviewed the various federal contractors that were doing resettlement in Tennessee, and they decided to appoint Catholic Charities of Tennessee as the what they call the state refugee coordinator. And then Catholic Charities opened a department within their agency called the Tennessee Office for Refugees, which is a little misleading, but they don't represent the state. They represent the refugee industry in Tennessee. Well, Tennessee Office for Refugees, if you look at Catholic Charities of Tennessee's operations, and you can go on the website and look at their annual reports, Tennessee Office for Refugees is their biggest program, and their second biggest program is their refugee resettlement program, which actually gets money from the Tennessee Office for Refugees. So it's very much an in-house operation with a lot of incentive, a lot of financial incentive, because that's where the majority of their money is coming from. So, and now we see, so 4 years ago, another local office of one of the national quote-unquote voluntary agencies opened in Asheville, and now World Relief, which is another resettlement agency, it's one of the big nine nationals, they have a local office in Nashville, and they are looking to expand into Memphis. They are the second largest resettlement, Memphis, which is the second largest resettlement city in Tennessee after Nashville. So now you've got, you know, another you know, one of these national resettlement agencies looking to open
more bodies, more body centers, basically.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that's what they do.
I've got to take a quick read here, real quick, and then we'll get right back. And when I finish this, though, here in a second, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, supposedly we have a government shutdown, and I'm just curious how that's affecting the refugee reprogram in Tennessee. There comes a time when good things have to give way to great things. ConservativeNationMedia.com is growing like a Texas Longhorn, which is why Michael B. Smith now has his own show. Check out Soldier of Patriotism, Sundays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Central on ConservativeNationMedia.com. But don't be worried. He's the same Michael B. you've come to know and love, and you'll hear even more great interviews and awesome conservative commentary from our very own main man, Michael B. Smith, on Soldier of Patriotism, Sundays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Central, on ConservativeNationMedia.com, where America always wins. Welcome back to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. The phone number is 718-305-7176, and we're talking to Joanne Bregman about refugee resettlement in Tennessee. The shutdown, what effect, if any, has this had on the refugee program, and or what has it done to expose how reliant they are on federal dollars?
Well, I would look back at what happened just a couple of years ago. This was in 2012 in Bowling Green, Kentucky. That year, they have resettled a lot of Iraqi refugees in Bowling Green. And what was discovered was that there were two Iraqi refugees that had been resettled, brought in through the refugee program and resettled in Kentucky, and they were arrested and charged with sending aid to al-Qaeda. And it interestingly turned out that federal government had been following them for a while. They had their fingerprints on file, and they were still able to come in through the refugee resettlement program. I mean, it's so reminiscent of what happened in Boston with the Sarnez brothers who came in through the asylum program. But so in response to what happened in Kentucky, the Department of Homeland Security really tightened down on security clearances. Well, that slowed the resettlement process for people who were in the pipeline because they were going back and really trying to be even more thorough with the security clearances. And a big cry went up from the resettlement industry because it affected their cash flow. They get paid per head. So for every refugee they resettle, they make a per capita. In fact, a year ago, there was on the news in West Tennessee, Memphis, Catholic Charities has an office there, and they resettled a Somali family of 12. It was a mother and 11 children, and you know, age one. There was an infant to age 20. And in the interview, the representative from Catholic Charities said that, you know, the older son, 20, he's the oldest, didn't speak the language. They had just been resettled. But he was going to go out and get a job. And even though he was probably going to make minimum wage, you know, he was going to be able to help support this family. You know, what they didn't say was, well, look, with all those kids, they were all on 10. They were all eligible for 10 care. They were all eligible for food stamps. I mean, there's a lot of subsidy that goes along with that. But when Catholic Charities resettled that family of 12, they were paid for each individual person that was resettled, not the family, but each individual person. So when going back to what happened in Bowling Green, when the Department of Homeland Security tightened up the security clearances, it really slowed down the arrival of refugees. Well, it also slowed down the cash flow to the resettlement agencies. And, in fact, I have a copy of a letter that one of the workers of Catholic Charities in Nashville sent to Senator Alexander and Senator Corker, really pleading for their job because they said, look, if our agency doesn't get the money, I'm going to lose my job. And then, of course, secondarily, the refugees won't get the services they need, but they were really concerned about their own job. And so what the State Department did was they turned around. The State Department is one avenue that money flows into the resettlement agencies. They get money from two different sources. The direct per capita per individual for the actual what they call reception and placement, which is the taking care of the arrival and the placement, you know, bringing the refugee into a community, that money comes from the State Department to the resettlement agencies. The other flow of money comes from the U.S. Office of Refugee Resettlement through HHS, through the Tennessee Office for Refugees, and that's all different kinds of grants, and that's just a whole flow of other money. But anyway, so what the State Department agreed to do was to compensate the resettlement agencies as if they had resettled the 60,000 cap of refugees nationally. So basically they were saying to the refugee resettlement agencies, not to worry, we're going to give you your money even if the refugees don't arrive. You'll get your money.
Money for nothing, and money for nothing.
Money for nothing, yeah. So they guaranteed that money. And you know, I don't know what to say about it, but certainly it's not out of the realm of possibility. The precedent is there. The State Department has done it before. And it goes back again. We kind of come full circle that what you see is how reliant these federal contractors are
on our tax dollars
for that money,
yeah.
even though the original arrangement was otherwise, and they really
right.
should have the money in reserve, or really it was supposed to be the primary money, to support the resettlement activities. And you know, back
yeah.
in 1981, a couple of years ago rather, you know, they were looking at the resettlement program. It was in 2010. The U.S. Senate Committee on Foreign Relations held a hearing looking at the resettlement program. And they said, look, we're not sure if the national numbers of resettlement need to be decreased or the federal government has to put more money in it But they were able to say, you know, clearly the refugees are not being served. And, of course, nothing ever happened. Now, Senator Corker was on that committee, so, you know, his staff might have more insight or more information about
that. There's another
that.
Phone call to make. We're going to take a call quick. Got Kurt on the line here.
Sure.
Kurt, you have a question or a comment?
Yeah, Dave. And hey, Joanne, how are you?
Hi there. Good. How are you?
I'm okay. You know, time may not allow for addressing this issue tonight. If that's the case, maybe it'll be an issue we can take up at a later date. But I may have my tinfoil hat on too tight tonight. But here's the question: what hard evidence or credible evidence, if any, do we have, or do you think we can get that there may be some known terrorist activity affiliated people amongst these refugees, so-called refugees? It's been stated in the past that we knew, or someone knew, that there were Hamas people from over in Gaza or somewhere over there being shipped over here under a refugee resettlement program. We all know the story of the plane loads of Somalis flown into Nashville. What if anything, are you prepared to make a statement in that area on right now? Or like I said, if not time doesn't permit tonight, maybe later.
Yeah, well, I will tell you this. You know, we don't have that kind of information, but you know, we would be, I think, in denial. And it really came out during the, there was a Somali sex trafficking case in Nashville last year. It was a pretty big case. And, you know, what came out was people said, you know, they were challenging the birth date of one of the defendants. And they said, well, you know, he's really, they wanted to try him as an adult. And they said, well, but he's not, he's a juvenile. Well, they knew a birth date when they applied for refugee status, but now they claim sort of a different birth date. So, you know, what it points up is that vital documents are often, you know, bare, absent. It's hard to perhaps nail down some of the security issues if you really don't have good documentation in terms of vital documents of who that person is. I mean, I can't answer your question more specifically, but I will tell you, it was reported yesterday that subsequent to the massacre at the mall in Nairobi in Kenya, the Kenyan parliament is considering shutting down the, they have a very, very large refugee camp in Kenya that is filled with Somalis, and that's what they're debating in the Kenyan parliament. They're saying, look at the threat it poses to our citizens, and we really have to look very carefully at this. Now, what's happening in the United States? Well, you know, certainly as to the Somalis, we keep resettling them. You know, Nashville is not the top resettlement area for Somalis. We know Minnesota is, and, you know, they're struggling right now. There's some group that wants to open yet another Somali mosque. And no one seems to be willing to really take a good hard look at, is that in the long term in the best interest of national security, given what we already know about al-Shabaab, about the recruitment in the United States, about what al-Shabaab is doing, what al-Shabaab, you know, represents. So I think we're not even at the point of being able to ask and discuss those questions openly. And I think until we get to that point, you know, Kurt, we can't even ask the question you're posing. You know what you're called if you try to even ask the question. So
okay. Like I said, my tinfoil hat may be fitting too tight tonight.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm always open for having open, rational discussion. And, you know, if there are facts that can be brought to the table and information, objective information, I think it's always worthy of discussion. And, you know, unfortunately, there are many people, both inside and outside the government, who feel that sensitivities would be offended by just having the discussion. So I hope that at some point we get past that, and I hope that it's the point, it's sooner rather than later, because I think there are certainly valid reasons to have the discussion.
Let us hope we get past that point. It will be necessary at some point in time.
Yes.
Okay, thanks, Joanne.
Thanks, Kurt. Thanks for the call. 718-305-7176 is the phone number if you have a question or a comment. Now, this issue is, we're going to have part two. This was actually the first issue that the committee dealt with back in August, the Legislative Oversight Committee. And they're going to have a follow-up in November 12th. And there's hoping to get some information out of the out of Catholic Charities, and I guess some of the other refugee organizations as well, correct?
Yes. Well, my understanding is I can tell you, I can certainly report, the committee voted, motion was made, and the committee voted to have fiscal review, do a comprehensive or as comprehensively as possible review of the fiscal impact on the state of Tennessee. Now, part of being able to make that assessment, it would certainly be facilitated if information could be gotten from the resettlement agencies. I can tell you that one of the reasons, I mean, I think it's pretty widely known that we had a bill in this last session to do just that. And the reason that bill was put forward to require the federal contractors doing business in Tennessee, bringing people in, you know, having people who come from another continent brought to Tennessee and then signing them up for Tennessee benefits, you know, one of the reasons that we weren't able to get some of that data. You know, we were trying to figure out, we knew the federal government, as my testimony in committee was, federal government has very publicly and openly acknowledged that they shift those costs to the state. And we wanted to know, well, what does it cost? We have no idea. And it's a very relevant question, given that Medicaid expansion is a looming possibility. And we asked for the data. We got some very early data, and then it stopped. And subsequent requests were kind of, quote-unquote, indefinitely delayed. and so, you know, that was why, and I think it was done very appropriately. Senator Ketron's office was asking for the data, and I think it was very appropriate to put in a bill to say, look, yeah, we get that you're a federal contractor, but you do have, it's okay to disclose information to the state, and P.S., again, it's a matter of public record, there was a Republican on the committee who was vehemently opposed to the bill, and opposed on the basis of having watched a 60 Minutes video program about, you know, and quite frankly, we weren't talking about the merits of the program. We were talking really about the fact that our legislators pass a budget every year. They have a duty to know where the money is going and how it's being spent. And so, you know, it was a relevant question, and quite frankly, I think it's a question that really impacts their fiduciary duty in that regard. The most vocal opponent on the committee just was more interested in kind of an emotional argument, if you will, as opposed to a very rational, objective, position that the bill was taking, and quite frankly, all the data that was requested was data that we knew the resettlement agencies had or could easily obtain because of the work they were doing, as reflected by the requirements that were in the agreement signed with the federal government. They are required to track certain data. Now, whether or not they do, nobody ever monitors. And the system that is set up, the federal system that is set up, They may get a monitoring visit once every 3 or 4 years from a federal monitor, and even if they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing, they get sort of corrective action. There's no penalty, so they could, like,
right,
you know, ignore every requirement, and then they'll just be told, well, look, you know, you really need to fix this. But that's all it is.
It's scary that, you know, one of our legislators would rely on 60 Minutes for making a decision on a bill. That's pretty sad.
Well, and I think especially when you're talking about, you know, this is big business. The refugee resettlement, and like I said, I used to volunteer for a refugee resettlement agency. You know, I used to drive people to their doctor's appointments. I did a number of things because the humanitarian aspect is certainly a worthy and important pursuit. There's no question about what the nature of the work is. And certainly there's no question that people who are suffering and need help, you know, we should be looking at that. However, that's not even what we're talking about. We're talking about the cost and what it means in terms of the relationship between the state government and the federal government. Because, Dave, if we don't start looking at this and these kinds of programs and asking the very hard questions, we are going to wake up one day and realize that we have a very different form of government than what was originally set up in the Constitution.
Well, I think we're already there.
Federalism.
It's a matter of getting it back. Joanne, I appreciate you coming on. Always very informative, and I'll have you on in the not-too-distant future, and we'll follow up on this some more. I appreciate you being with us.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
All right, always good to have you. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Don't go. Let's assume that if you're listening to conservativenationmedia.com, you're a conservative. You love America just like we do, and you don't want to get caught short in the case the leftist government drops the ball and leaves the country and your family unable to get the basics of life in an emergency. Since that's the case, you're going to want a supply depot to get everything from patriotic gear to survival necessities to outfit and protect you and your family. And your pipeline of those essentials is right here at conservativenationmedia.com. Just go to our website, conservativenationmedia.com, and click on the Patriot Depot banner. That will take you to the world's best-known warehouse for all your conservative and emergency survival needs. Wave your flag and be ready for whatever the future holds starting right now. Just go to conservativenationmedia.com and click on the Patriot Depot banner to join the conservative revolution, where America always wins. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Hey, there he is. How's it going?
I'm having a stroke.
Are you going to shake my hand or what?
I'm having a stroke.
Wow, you're not even moving your arm.
I'm having a stroke.
Are you okay?
I'm having a stroke.
Your face looks weird too.
I'm having a stroke.
Are you having a seizure or something?
I'm having a stroke.
When someone is having a stroke, they may not be able to say it with words, but their body language will tell you loud and clear.
I'm having a stroke.
You just need to know the sudden signs. Look for FAST, F-A-S-T. F, face drooping. A, arm weakness. Or S, speech difficulty. Then T, time. Time to call 911 immediately. Because the sooner they get to the hospital, the sooner they'll get treatment. And that can make a remarkable difference in their recovery. Know the sudden signs. Face, arm, speech, time. Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. The phone number is 718-305-7176. And our next guest is Gary Lehman. We're going to talk with Gary about the new organization that was formed to kind of replace the Boy Scouts, replace what's been destroyed, I guess you could say, or is in the process of being destroyed. And it's called Trail Life USA, if I'm reading that correctly. Gary, you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, did I get that name right? Okay.
You got it right.
Now you're not in the hierarchy of this new organization, as I understand it. You're kind of one of the foot soldiers, I guess you could say.
That's accurate. I'm assistant scoutmaster. I've been a scoutmaster. I've been in scouting for a lot of years. When we found out in June that there was going to be a conference of about 50 insiders, and these are really high-level adult scouters. Some of them are professional scouters, two of which I met gave up their scouting career as professionals. Others had been scoutmasters and what have you, Eagle Scouts, really, you know, some of the top-notch adult scouters had met, and they studied to see if it was feasible, if there'd be an interest, put survey out. The survey came back, ping, 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 from lots of people. The end result, some weeks ago, we had a convention in Nashville, and when I say we, they did, and I went to it. There were about 30,000 people.
Wow.
Basically wanted to come, but about 1,230-something came. And that was about $400. So I added it up. If you stay for a hotel room or whatever, you know, staying there at the airport, I believe it was the, shoot, help me here, Music City. Hotel
okay.
there, Sheridan, and those, I mean, it was a really nice place. Those people spent a lot of money. They flew in from all the states in the union except maybe one or two. They came in from Alaska, Hawaii, spent a lot of money to come to the conference. And it was a convention. And there was displayed the new name and everything about the new organization, and it was impressive.
Now, as obviously this new organization is going to make sure that it can't go down the road that the Boy Scouts went down in the past. I'm going to get into that a little bit. But other than that, was this pretty much a reinvention? I mean, was there anything new that, besides that, about this organization, where is it pretty much the Scouts revisited and they're going to make sure that they can't be taken down the wrong road?
This, good question. This was a built from scratch, bottom up, top down organization. And believe me, the talent that was involved, I mean, a lot of these people are CEOs of their own companies. Okay. Mike Ferris is the legal counsel for Dr. Dobson, Focus on the Family, for homeschoolers throughout the country. Devout Christian, he's part of the legal team, and a number of legal team who were with the BSA and walked were part of that legal team. And they, in a few months, went ahead and took best practices of scouting, what they knew and what they wanted to go away, and they built an organization that copyright-wise is protected because it doesn't, you know, instead of a scoutmaster, you have a troop master. You don't have Cub Scouts and Boys, and then the Boy Scouts. You have an organization that starts from the younger age group and works their way up. So the new Boy Scout level itself, starting at age 11, those are adventure scouts, okay? They're the adventures, and that's how they built it. They pulled it together and decided to increase standards. They focused heavily on the family orientation, and they faith-based a church, no secular institutions, no corporations of any kind, but faith-based, a church, for example. And now you can be of another religion, but you will take, you will promise to follow the Christian model of conduct. and it's basically a purity pledge, and it is a faith statement. And only a church can charter. It's got to be a Christian organization, a church that charters.
Okay. And what's the statement of faith? Is it a generic statement or
It's a generic. Well, it's not so much generic. Basically, it prevents any argument as to what morally straight is and how you're supposed to conduct yourself. It would be similar to, some churches have a faith statement that you have to take, and centers around the Judeo-Christian faith. And that is the charter organization. So there's no wiggle room.
Okay.
I don't have it in front of me to read it to you. I've kind of failed in that. Been doing other things. I don't have that for me right in front of me. But I can tell you it's restricted from that point. Now, there's no politicalization of sexual orientation or anything of that nature. The bottom line is there's a way that we will conduct ourselves, and we are led by a very high moral standard. That is the tone of it all. And, of course, building boys into men who are going to be leaders in industry, in the church, in ministry, or anywhere in the country, but they're leaders and they're built on a strong foundation of skill sets, career-oriented skill sets, and then, of course, the pioneer and the other adventure skill sets that are necessary. But the end result is you have a solid person there who basically is built from youth into the type of person we want in our country to save our country from the direction it's going in. There's no compromise with corporations. That's been one of the issues. Corporations in the military have taken advantage of the Eagle Scout program for decades. And, but look at what's happened as a result. And there was no attention paid by a lot of churches as to the organization they had chartered. And basically a lot of the committees, the church charter has a committee that oversees that troop. A lot of them just, were paying the dues.
They just assume it's Boy Scouts. We don't have to worry about them.
That's exactly right. That is exactly right. There's the assumption. Now, here's where another aspect of that I believe is very good. The framework of Trail Life USA is that it's much more decentralized. There are no councils. There is a national headquarters in Texas, in Austin. There are no councils, and the church, the charter organization, deals directly with the national level. And the tracking system they have.
Gary, let me step in here just a second. I've got to do a quick read, and then we can start right. We can take right where we're leaving off here, okay?
All right.
The left can't stand the Second Amendment and Americans' right to keep and bear arms. And now there's something else they're sure to hate. It's the Second Amendment Forum on conservativenationmedia.com with Maxwell Winchester Roberts. We welcome Max and his decades of firearms and Second Amendment rights experience to Thursday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central. The leftist administration in D.C. wants to disarm the American people, and Max just won't let that happen. The Second Amendment Forum, Thursdays at 8 p.m., 7 Eastern, Central on conservativenationmedia.com, where America always wins. Welcome back to Inside Tennessee and Conservative Nation Media. We're talking with Gary Lima about the new organization to replace the Scouts. It's called Trail Life USA. And Gary, you were talking about the structure of the organization before we took the little read there.
Yes, it's more decentralized, where the autonomy is at the local level. And the national level is there to assist, even with area representatives, the management and the growth of that, let's say, troop, for example, if you're talking about the adventure level, okay? And, of course, you have younger scouts who would have been called Cub Scouts but won't be. But you got the younger youth. All of them are broken into three age sets of age group, and they grow together until they finish at age 18. There is no Eagle Scout. That there is an equivalent, and the standards are a bit higher. And that is a freedom, you know, he's a freedom scout, a freedom rank. And it's very patriotic, and there's no equivocation on what that means either.
Well, now let me ask you this. Let me ask you a question, because you say it's more decentralized and there's no councils. Were the councils part of the problem, and if so, how?
No, well, okay, it depends on who you talk to. The councils grew into very professional organizations, okay. BSA at one point was decentralized, more local autonomy, but because it became bigger and bigger and bigger, and you're dealing with product line and professional, it's just like any organization that just keeps growing, 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 as long as the money's coming. And these are great, great organizations, but they became unwieldy, some believe, and record keeping is a difficult thing as it is. And now there's a program for the Troop Master, which works directly with the National. Whatever that troop is doing, whatever they're doing for rank advancement, merit badges, that sort of thing, very well-kept system. It's a system that was built by the same company 10 years ago for the BSA, but that hadn't been fully utilized. Now that onus is right there on that charter. You maintain that, and then we're going to monitor how you're doing. And as long as you stay within policy, then you're okay. And that's basically what they've done there. And I don't want to knock the council, so to speak, but when you have a middle level and so many people involved, and in addition to that, that's one of the issues. You had a majority of 51% delegates vote the new policy for the BSA, which did not represent the councils across the country overall. It was 79% opposed and 89% in Middle Tennessee. But what happened is you have these board members that sit there and they become delegates, and they might be from the corporate world, right? And
right.
They might be more liberal in whatever, and they end up taking power away from the local and voted against the local, and so it's almost like Congress, you know. What do we really care what you people think? You know, you're all the volunteers out there. You're doing it. You're working hard, but what do we care about what you think? You know, disapprove of us
right.
as delegates, and we're okay. And that's as simplistic as I can make it without doing a full presentation, which, by the way, if you go to the Trail Life USA website, there is a presentation, a video. It's about a half hour more long, and you can Google it, and it goes through the structure of the program. In fact, it talks about why they did what they did and what we're about.
Ah, good. That's
very,
very a good one to have.
Uh-huh.
Gary, I'm going to have to take a real quick break, if you can stay with us for a few more minutes, and take a quick one, and we'll be right back.
Okay.
We'll be right back. Don't go away.
If you love America, you're among friends here.
Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine.
At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower.
Hey,
I start laundry
this
at 8. At 10, we
Jared
go for a walk.
Clean up that kitchen.
Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m.
For those dealing with the daily struggles of caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community with experts and other caregivers for advice, tips, and support. Together, let's help each other better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
The first thing I remember knowing was a lonesome whistle blowing and a youngin's dream of growing up to ride on a freight train leaving town, not knowing where I'm bound, and no one could change my mind, but Mama tried.
Welcome back to Inside Tennessee on Conservative Nation Media. I'm your host, Dave Vance. The phone number is 718-305-7176, and we're talking with Gary Lima about the new scouting organization, Trail Life USA. Gary, you with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Now, how did the money became the issue, apparently, with one of the reasons the scouts went the direction they did. Now, this new organization is more decentralized. So are the local churches, the charter organizations, are they going to provide the funding? And are the scouts, I imagine, going to do their own fundraisers to basically fund whatever activities they want to do rather than trying to rely on some corporate sponsor?
Yes, it's both. And it's been that way, too. And when you eliminate councils, boy, you sure do eliminate a whole lot of overhead. And that's where the national and the council levels, where the corporations got the control. Now, saying that, there will be no donations accepted through United Way or anything the federal government touches. There will be none from the corporate world.
Now, what's the issue with United Way?
Well, as soon as you go through that, okay, you're touching federal monies to run United Way. There's a lot of, you know, there's a blurry area between what donations, charity, and what federal dollars are. That's what's affecting all the other politics with this new wave progressive movement in hospitals and whatever. Anytime you touch a federal dollar, you can be a charity, anything, you're going to start singing their song.
Right, right.
So the legal team that's been on board for the several months have looked at every aspect of how to prevent forced influence, whether it's through the corporate world or whether it's through the federal government. True.
Now, are you still going to? Okay, so you're not going to have anything to do with the military installations anymore, then? Is that accurate?
Well, you know, that's one of those. You know, we don't know how many unintended consequences are we're at right now. And I'm not saying we, let me speak for them in this way. I went to the convention, and this is my understanding. That's why family's praying about it. And we are more than likely going to make that decision, have to present to our church in effective 1 January, be a new charter. But there are things out there we don't know what the impact is. Now, a lot of the questions that were asked had to do with the impact. For example, you know, where are we going to go and train? Are we going to have a reservation? Are we going to have this and that? Well, you know, a lot of donors have pulled out of the BSA, and those are the wealthy
right.
people. And they're the ones that are saying, don't worry about where you're going to get the summer camp to be. Continue to find land like we always do in places and farms where you can do camperies. But don't worry about. Scouts, don't worry about the transition to Trail Life USA. If you decide to come to Trail Life USA. I mean, this can be as benign as you have a scout troop and you have a Trail Life troop in, under the same charter organization. Some boys won't cross over, others will. But as far as the Trail Life goes, everything that you've done in scouting all the way up to Eagle Scout, you know, if you came over, that transition and transitions into the new rank order structure. And a lot of those merit badges, okay, well, all the merit badges you'll get credit for. But that's the other interesting thing. They've got about 50 hardcore merit badges that they are going to require you to entertain doing any number of them as part of your rank advancement. But also, there'll be many, 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 many more, and they don't have the total count, but they're going to be career-oriented. Okay, so in fact, a troop, and it's going to take several years to develop this part, but if boys have an interest in a particular career field and it can be justified and there's interest around the country, then that can become a merit badge.
Do you think that you know, the same radical organizations that basically, I'll say, attack the Boy Scouts, because that's quite honestly what they did, and they did it over a number of years,
right,
in different ways. Do you think they will just leave the Trail Life organizations alone, or how do you expect them to maybe find a way to finagle into the organization, or maybe a lawsuit, this, that, or the other? What are your concerns in that area?
I'll give you the one opinion that was presented on the legal side at the convention, and then two opinions from me. One is they have done everything they can to firewall and prevent any entry through a back door legally. And there were a number of variables they cited, very sharp constitutional lawyers, and, of course, Mike Ferris, who is an extremely powerful litigant, has been defending homeschoolers all over the country for years. So they say that they have that block. Now, that doesn't say that you don't get attacked.
Right.
But they can fall back on, and now this is my opinion, what I thought I understood, they can always fall back on the Supreme Court decision as a new scouting organization that they don't have to compromise their moral values. So you see, the precedent with the Supreme Court was set. The BSA just went ahead and said, yeah, all that money and whatever. But with all the sneaking in influence on the corporate level and whatever, that's where the decision was made against the will of the vast majority of adult scouters and Boy Scouts, okay?
Yeah.
That was done. Well, that Supreme Court decision still holds. So an attack means, okay, you want to go ahead and do a lawsuit. This is a Supreme Court decision that defends Trail Life USA. Whether BSA forfeited that or not, that's their problem. And the
right.
other opinion I have on this is assume, and based on the politics we see now and what's in D.C. and what's going on in our country, there's going to be attacks. If you were as perfect as Jesus Christ himself, and every I is dotted and every T is crossed.
Well, that's pretty much what they are attacking already. I mean, the root of what they're attacking for the most part. Well, Gary, we've got less than a minute left. Any parting thoughts? And by the way, I really appreciate you coming on, and we'll have you back as this organization gets going and you can give us a report on it. But anything you'd like to throw out there before we have to pull the plug for the night?
Yeah, I think everyone that's involved in scouting, and any family that wants to be involved in scouting because their kids are growing into that age where they can get involved in such a program, need to look at Trail Life USA. and go to their website and get the material from there and the videos that they have, the presentation and the organizational structure and what they believe in the policy. And know this, too. By January, they will have a new scout handbook. There'll be about 200 pages, yeah. Whatever, but there'll be a new scout handbook, and it is literally supported by scripture quotes out of the Bible. So a boy knows beyond a shadow of doubt what he's doing.
Gary, we're out of time. Thanks again for being with us, and we will definitely have you back. God bless you.
God bless you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks
for listening. We'll see you next week.